Our Torah portion is the last Torah portion of the Torah cycle and begins in Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 1. This Torah portion is called Vezot HaBaraka. A baraka is a blessing. HaBaraka means the blessing. Vezot means and this. And this is the blessing. And what's going to be happening here, I'm sure as you've read this, you've noticed it this week, is that Moses is going to speak a blessing over the tribes of Israel. This is the last day of Moses' life, and he is doing what Jacob did on the last day of his life, or near the end of his life, when Jacob called his sons around him, and he spoke a blessing, and it was a prophetic blessing over each one. And then he died. Those sons had children, and who had children, and now each son has grown into a tribe made up of tens of thousands. And now here's Moses speaking over the fruit of Jacob's sons, over his descendants. And again, he speaks blessings. And what's interesting is that when Jacob, back in Genesis 49, speaks these blessings over his sons, after he's spoken these blessings, it ends with the phrase, Vezot hadavarim asher dever lahem. And these are the blessings that he spoke to them. So Jacob ends his blessings with the word vezot. Here, this portion begins with the word vezot. Now get the picture. Jacob's blessings, the word vezot. Then you fast forward several hundred years. And then here's Moses, the last day of his life, about to speak blessings of Israel. He starts with the word vezot. The sages take this as they do. They're so clever the way they put things together. And they say this word that Jacob ends with, being the same word that Moses starts with, means that we just kind of bring the two together. And that Moses' prophetic blessings are a continuation of Jacob's. And in many ways they are. You'll see some similar terminology. And you'll see things take a few changes, a few turns. But you really need to study these two, like two sides of the menorah. Jacob's blessings, Moses' blessings, and put them side by side, then you get the balanced, full picture. Well, let's just jump right in. And this is the blessing that Moses, the man of God, bestowed upon the children of Israel before his death. He said, Adonai came from Sinai, having shone forth to them from Seir, having appeared from Mount Paran, and then approached with some of the holy myriads. And I love this next line. From his right hand, he presented the fiery Torah. Now, the word Torah is not there. The word fiery, and then they stick the word Torah in there, is one word in Hebrew. It's H dot. H dot. H means fire, dot means law. And it's combined into one word, fire law. Fiery instruction, fiery Torah. We don't know how to translate it exactly. But the H dot. This is interesting because our God is a consuming fire. And when he made his blood covenant with Abraham, Abraham cut the parts of the covenant in half. And then it says there in Genesis that a smoking furnace, what's in a smoking furnace, by the way? Fire. And a torch, and what's on the torch? Fire. Passed between the pieces. Now, why did God just use a smoking furnace or just a torch? Why did he use both? His fire has two aspects, God's trying to teach us. A torch will give off heat, but its main purpose is to give light. A furnace will give off light, but its main purpose is to give off heat. And if you look at the word Esh in Hebrew, it's two letters. Aleph, which happens to be the first letter of the word Or, light. And Sheen, which is the letter of fire. A couple weeks ago we talked about the letter Sheen and how it looks like fire, and it represents a tooth that consumes. And God's trying to teach that his essence can be described in two ways. There's light, but there's fire. Light is only for the eye, isn't that correct? You can't hear light, you can't feel light, you can't taste it or smell it, it's only for the eye. But heat, you feel that everywhere else. In other words, there's an absolute spiritual aspect that we must have spiritual vision to catch about God. But then there's also this physical awareness that in everything around us, and in the pressures and the experiences God brings into our life, there's also something of Himself He's trying to teach us. We often like the light, but we don't care for the heat. But when God comes in your life, it's a package deal. He will bring light and illumination and instruction, and He'll help you to see and to understand, but He's going to bring His refining heat as well. Because what's the purpose of a furnace? You put something in it, and when you take it back out, it is completely different. It's changed. And that's what God will do with you. And He will apply the heat. He'll separate the dross from what is pure. And then we come to Paul's writings. And it says the day is coming when every man's work will be tried by fire, right? As to what quality. Is that what he says? What quality is. Not quantity, quality. Hay, wood, and stubble, that goes up the chimney of the furnace. Silver, gold, precious stones, that remains. And then later, on the Isle of Patmos, John has a vision of Yeshua and describes his hair and his dress and his voice and everything. But when he looks into his eyes, what did he see in Yeshua's eyes? Fire. Eyes are the window to the what? The soul. When you look into the soul of Yeshua, you see God. You see the fire. Our God's a consuming fire. You see how this all works, all fits together? So what is this all about? If God gave us an eshdat, a fiery law, that law is an expression of His very essence. And to say that that law has been passed away and replaced with something new means to say that God has passed away and replaced with another God. When you edit God's word, you edit God. So let's not mess with His word and try to change it. It is as eternal as He is. It's an eshdat that comes from His right hand, never to change. It will change us. We do not change it. Verse 3. Indeed, you love the tribes greatly. All its holy ones are in your hands. For they planted themselves at your feet, bearing the yoke of your utterances. There's that word. We're going to go on. The Torah, verse 4. The Torah that Moses commanded us is the heritage of the congregation of Jacob. He became king over Yeshurun. When the numbers of the nation, or when the leaders of the nation gathered, the tribes of Israel in unity. And now Moses speaks over the tribes. May Reuben live and not die, and may his population be included in the count. Apparently, Reuben was in some danger of disappearing. And so Moses prays for Reuben that he would endure. And then he skips to the fourth son of Jacob. He skips over the middle two for a moment. He goes from Reuben to Judah. Verse 7. And this to Judah. And he said, hearken, O Adonai, Shema Adonai, to Judah's voice, and bring or return him to his people. Now this is very interesting. What does it mean, return Judah to his people? Judah never left his people. Judah is right there. He had been right there all the time. What's Moses talking about, return Judah to his people? Pardon me? Possibly, but I think there's a better answer. And it's connected to another verse. Go down to the prophecy over Joseph. Down a little further in the chapter. He starts with Joseph in verse 13, but we're going to move on down to verse 16. Are we there? 33:16. And with the bounty of the land and its fullness, and by the favor of him who rested upon the thorn bush, may this blessing rest upon Joseph's head, and upon the crown of him who was separated from his brothers. Now here's what's interesting. Joseph is spoken of as being separated from his brothers. But then Moses talks about Judah returning to his brothers. What is going on here? Well, in Jewish theology, and most of you know this if you've been studying Jewish theology at all, you know that the rabbis look into the prophecies and they see something they can't reconcile. They see prophecies about the coming Messiah, to them the coming Messiah. They don't believe Yeshua was the Messiah, that the Messiah has come yet. But they see prophecies of a coming Messiah where this Messiah is rejected by men. He doesn't come on a horse to take a man. He comes on a donkey. He's one who's not that attractive. He's one who's put to death. But then they see other prophecies concerning a victorious ruler, a conquering king who comes with the clouds, who comes to set up a kingdom that will never be shaken, never destroyed. They're thinking, what's going on here? Which is it? And so in Jewish theology, they're looking for two messiahs. And they call the one messiah Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph, because they compare him to Joseph, because Joseph was rejected by his brothers, right? Sold into slavery. He sold for silver, by the way. Sold by Judah, by the way. And to slavery, he goes and lives among the Gentiles during 7 years of terrible tribulation. His brothers, his Jewish brethren, come to him, but they don't recognize him. They think he's just an Egyptian. But he recognizes them. And one thing leads to another, and during these 7 terrible years, Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. Joseph, who at that time was the savior of the world, because he taught Egypt how to prepare for this famine. And during the years of famine, not only was Egypt fed, but that says the whole world came to Joseph to live, to get food. He was the savior of the world. This incognito brother, this lost Joseph, who they thought was dead. So they call the one Messiah, Mashiach ben Yosef, Messiah son of Joseph. But then they say, now these other prophecies describe someone who looks completely different. And they call him Mashiach ben David, Messiah son of David. Because they know that the Messiah comes from the tribe of Judah. And like David, he'll be a king. He'll shepherd his people. He'll conquer. He'll be a warrior. He'll establish the kingdom and establish a throne forever. That's how they try to reconcile these two seemingly irreconcilable sets of prophecies. But now we know the truth. It's not two messiahs. It's one messiah who comes two times. And the first time he came as Yeshua ben Yosef. Mary's husband's name was Joseph, wasn't he? And he was rejected by his brothers. He was sold for silver. He was put to death. And now so many Gentiles recognize this Jewish Messiah, and so many Jews don't. They think he's just dead. And so, it's interesting in Moses' prophecies, he refers to Joseph as the one who was separated from his brothers. He refers to Judah as the one who will return to his people. But isn't that perfect? Because Messiah, son of Joseph, came 2,000 years ago and was separated from his brothers. But he's going to return as Judah, as the son of David, the king, the lion of the tribe of Judah. It's a fascinating story, isn't it? Anyways, there's much more. Let's keep going. And return him to his people. May his hands fight his grievance. And may you be a helper against his enemies. So he's coming back as a warrior, isn't he? And then we come to verse 8. Of Levi, or Levi as it's pronounced, he said, your Tumim and your Urim befit your devout one, whom you tested at Massa, and whom you challenged at the waters of Meribah. Now remember that the priestly tribe is the tribe of Levi. In fact, the word Levi means connected or joined. And Levi is what was the priestly tribe that joined God and his people. They were the go-betweens. They taught the Torah of God to the people, and they brought the sacrifices of the people to God. They worked in the temple, and they would judge certain matters, and they were the go-betweens. They were the priests. And inside the high priest, ephod, the breastplate he wore with the 12 stones with the names of the 12 tribes on them. Inside there was a pocket. It was a piece of, the ephod was like a piece of cloth folded in half to make a square. And in that pocket were the Urim and the Thummim. And we don't know what they were. Some people think they were like two stones. Some people think it was a piece of parchment with God's name, his four-letter name written. But we do know that on various times of the scriptures, when Israel had a question that they needed to know the answer to, they would go to the high priest and consult the Urim and the Thummim, and somehow these two stones, this piece of parchment, whatever, would give them the answer. God would speak to them through this. Some say that the letters in the stones on the breastplate would light up and spell out words. Who knows? I don't know. But we do know this, that through the Urim and the Thummim, God would reveal his will. So he says, your Thummim and your Urim befit your devout one, whom you tested at Massa and whom you challenged at the waters of Meribah. Now what's interesting, this is news. Now we know about Massa and Meribah by reading the Torah, where the Israelites are going through the wilderness, there's no water, and they gripe and whine and complain, unlike any of us would do. And God provides water. Then later on, there's no water, and they continue to whine and gripe and complain, and Moses strikes the rock, and water comes out. And though it's not revealed there, here it would seem that when everybody was whining and complaining, Levi didn't. When everybody was griping, no water, we're thirsty, Levi was silent and did not complain and bellyache. So, I don't know how else to interpret that. That's what Rashi says also, and it just seems like there's no other interpretation for that. Verse 9, the one who said of his father and mother, I have not favored him. His brothers he did not give recognition, and his children he did not know. What this is referring to is that the sin of the golden calf. Remember this? Moses has gone up onto the mountain, Mount Sinai. He's been gone for 40 days, 40 nights. And they thought, he's supposed to be back by now. And somebody rises up and says, make us gods so that they can lead us through the wilderness or back to Egypt or whatever, but we need a god. So they make this idol out of gold, the golden earrings, this golden calf. They begin to worship and they're having parties, and you can begin to imagine how crazy that was. I mean, what if you had these slaves, who've been slaves for centuries, also they have freedom, and mom and dad have left the house, you know what I'm saying? And so here they are, they just start partying like crazy, except for the tribe of Levi. And when Moses comes down, he says, whoever's on the Lord's side, come near him. And there's the tribe of Levi who had not demeaned themselves in this partying. And Moses commands them, every man strap his sword onto his side. And go through here, wherever you see the people committing sin, you kill them. You have to eradicate this from Israel. And Levi did that. That's what it's referring to. He didn't take mercy on his family members. If they were in sin, Levi took the sword and put an end to it. His brothers he did not give recognition, and his children he did not know. For they, the Levites, have observed your word, and your covenant they preserved. They shall teach your ordinances to Jacob, and your Torah to Israel. They shall place incense before your presence, and burnt offerings on your altar. Bless, O Adonai, his resources, and favor the work of his hands. Smash the loins of his foes and his enemies, that they may not rise. I don't know of any place in the Torah that describes Levi in such glowing terms as yet. But one of the things I want us to notice is this. Because Levi, according to Moses' description here, was so faithful to God, even when everyone else was falling away, everyone else was just giving in to the flesh, Levi stood strong. Levi was given special insight to God's will, the Urim and the Thummim. They were given the privilege of teaching God's Torah to Israel. They were given the privilege of burning incense to God, which is always a picture of prayer. By the way, one of the rabbis pointed out something interesting. They said that the only sense, the only one of the five senses not involved in the fall in the garden with Adam and Eve, the only sense of the five that was not involved in the first sin is the sense of smell. And she saw the fruit that was pleasant to the eyes. It was good for food. She had to reach out and touch it and take it. She heard the serpent's voice, but smell is not mentioned anywhere. It's funny that smell is the weakest of our five senses, except for Robin. It's the weakest of our five senses, and yet it's the one that's most connected to memory. And it's the one that is connected and exemplifies prayer, because incense is something that always exemplifies prayer, from the Torah all the way to Revelation. Kind of interesting. The one thing that wasn't used in the sin of the garden. But that's I'm digressing here. I think there's a lesson here, and that is that we stand strong for God. When others are falling, God privileges us with a special closeness to Him. I think for every one of us, our relationship to God will be tested. And as we fail the test, we have to go back to home plate and take up the bat and try a swing at the ball again. But as we stand up to temptation and to a temptation to compromise, God allows us to advance and become closer to Him. But our relationships will be tested. And it seems so unfair. I think the ones who experience the most temptation in this world are our teenagers. And I think the ones who have the least life experience to prepare them for those temptations are our teenagers. So the only thing I know to do is, parents, teach them well, pray for them, and realize God runs the world. Now, Ben was over yesterday for a bit, and he asked a question, and it led to the main part of the study tonight. He says, well, how come Simeon is not mentioned in these blessings? As you go through here, you'll notice Simeon is not there. And so, Ben, I think I'm going to try to answer your question tonight. Levi and Simeon. Jacob says, Levi and Simeon are brothers. Go back to Genesis. We'll start with Genesis chapter 29. We're going to go take a real quick history of Levi and Simeon. I think there's a very important lesson for every one of us. So I think every one of us have a bit of Levi and a bit of Simeon inside of us. And we're either going to follow the one or the other. Back in Genesis 29, you know the story of how Jacob fell in love with Rachel. After 7 years, the wedding night finally comes. He goes in, has his honeymoon with Rachel in the morning, wakes up and realizes, this ain't Rachel. This is Rachel's suggliester, Leah. And so, of course, Jacob was really upset. So his uncle Laban, or Rachel's uncle Laban, says, oh, work another 7 years, you can have Rachel too. So now Jacob's got two wives, two for the price of two. One of them he loves, another one he just doesn't care for much. So what does God do? He opens the womb of Leah. She has a son, names him Reuben, which means, look, a son. And then she has a son named Simeon, which means he hears, Shema, Shimon, God has heard my prayer. And then she has a third son. For somebody who doesn't care for his wife much, she's had a lot of kids, you know, but she gives birth to Levi, which means connected. It says, now my husband's heart will be connected. It will be joined to mine because I've given him three sons. Then she has a fourth son, Judah. And then she left off bearing children for a while. She'll eventually have two more sons, but she had four in a row. Now what's interesting is that these two middle sons, Simeon and Levi, Leah is having these sons and she's hoping that through these sons she'll win the heart of her husband Jacob because she loves him. And I think there's a bit that passed on to Levi and Simeon, which is this wanting to be loved. Wanting to be loved by God. This desire to somehow draw close to Him. And I think every one of us have a bit of Levi and Simeon within us. But Levi and Simeon have something else in common. They were definitely men of action, men of strong passions. Because as you go a little bit further in the story, to chapter 34, Levi and Simeon are grown men. All the sons have been born, except for maybe, has Benjamin been born yet? I forget if Benjamin has been born. But either Benjamin has been born or he's about to be. But when you get to chapter 34, Jacob has returned to Israel. And instead of going south to see his father like he told Esau he's going to do, he turns north. For whatever reasons, it was a bad mistake. He goes north to Shechem. And while they're in Shechem, Jacob's only daughter, Jacob and Simeon, Judah, Reuben's sister, Dinah, as you might pronounce it. She's walking in the fields. One of the young men of Shechem lays eyes on her, instantly in love, and he rapes her. Well, Simeon and Levi are going to stand for this. And through some subterfuge and deceit, Levi and Simeon alone take up their swords, go into Shechem, and they destroy every male. They kill every man in the city. Levi and Simeon were together. None of the other brothers were involved. Not their older brother Reuben, not their younger brother Judah, or any of the other brothers all the way down the line. Just these two, Simeon and Levi, go together in a conspiracy. Let's go into Shechem. Let's show these guys what we do, the people who desecrate, violate our young sister. Jacob is very upset, obviously. And he says something very interesting. He says, "You've made my name stink among these Gentiles." There's a lesson here for us. Each of us is positioned to make the name of Yeshua stink, to make the name of God stink. God forbid. You're in a position to make the name of Beth Tikkun stink. So am I. And it happens when we operate out of our passions instead of out of self-control. And there's no question about it. Something needed to be done. But they didn't wait for the counsel of their father. They didn't wait to get together with their brothers to discuss this. They took action in a righteous anger. And they made Jacob's name stink. We need to be very careful. Because we can feel very justified. We may even have scriptural basis for some of the strong actions we take. And yet by taking those actions, trying to defend God's name, we can make his name stink. And we can destroy our testimonies. We need to go slowly. We need to think carefully. We need to practice self-control. And then this incident's not referred to again until Jacob's deathbed, and we come to Genesis chapter 49. And then Jacob prophesies over these two sons. So you come to Genesis 49. We'll start with verse 5. You can picture Jacob. He's a very old man now on his deathbed. He's had his sons come around. And just like Moses is prophesying over the tribes in Deuteronomy 33, back here we see Jacob prophesying over his 12 sons. Here in Genesis 49. Look what he says, verse 5, 49:5. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Well, duh. You know, all 12 of the brothers are brothers. Why did he take these two, just these two, and say these two are brothers? He's saying these two are so close, they're like connected at the hip. They see eye to eye, they have the same kind of passions, they see things the same way. And look what he says about them. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their weaponry is, and you know what the word is here in Hebrew? Hamas. Hamas. It's the same as the Palestinian group in Israel. Hamas, it means violence. And then look what he says in the next verse. Into their conspiracy may my soul not enter. With their congregation, do not join. You know, you can take that very literally. There are a lot of congregations out there. A lot of congregations. Akron, throughout the state, throughout the country, around the world. And the very essence of their existence is violence. Hamas. Maybe not so much physical violence, but there's a verbal violence, and when you listen to them, they stir up anger inside of you. Now, sin's awful, but hatred of sin does not necessarily mean love of righteousness. I want you to make sure you understand that. There are a lot of leaders around the landscape who hate sin. There's not much love for God, not much love for people, not much love for their own brothers and sisters in them. Don't ever equate hatred of sin with love of God. They are not the same. They don't necessarily have anything to do with each other. Now, hatred of sin is not bad. But I tell you, alone, I'm just telling you what Jacob says. Do not enter into their congregation. Have you ever watched a tele-evangelist sometimes, and it's just like they're stirring up the hate, you know, just everything's bad, everything's awful, can't wait for judgment to come to teach all these sinners a lesson. I remember one time watching one tele-evangelist, and I don't know what possessed me to do it, but I just turned the volume all the way off. I just looked at his face. Just look at his face. And I need to tell you, you can start to fill in words on your own. Well, they weren't nice. This guy's eyes are just blazing with hate. Blazing with anger. I'm thinking, somehow, that's not Yeshua. Now, we have to be capable of anger. God certainly is, and Yeshua demonstrated anger, but he was not a man of anger. He was a man of love who was capable of anger. There's a big difference between that and a man of anger who might sometimes rather, you know, had a child on the head. Even Hitler did that. Anyways, don't enter their congregation. Do not join. Oh, my honor, for in their rage they murdered people, and at their whim they hamstrung an ox. Now, keep that little phrase in mind, hamstrung an ox. That may be a reference to them killing the animals in Shechem as well, but it's singular. They hamstrung an ox. Keep that phrase in mind. Accursed is their rage, for it is intense. Now catch this. Cursed is their rage, for it is intense. I don't care how righteous your anger is. When it goes beyond a certain point, it is a curse. Because anger is an emotion that we, as flesh and blood, as human beings, cannot endure for very long. Because it will kill us and will certainly kill everything around us. It will destroy relationships. It will consume you. It will destroy your mind. It will take over your soul and bring destruction in its path. I don't care how righteous it is. Anger is a deadly emotion. And it can only be exercised for very short amounts of time. And then it must be put away. It must be put away. Anger is such a problem, it's something God hates so much, that a person who tends to get angry is disqualified from being an elder. Look at 1 Timothy. And a person who is given over to anger, just this kind of angry person, they're not even to be a part of the congregation, not to even eat with such a person. God hates anger. He hates it. Notice he says, love your neighbor. He doesn't say, love your neighbor and sin not. He doesn't say, be generous and sin not. He doesn't say, be kind and sin not. He says, be angry but sin not. In other words, anger brings you right up to the edge of the cliff. And unless you have total self-control, you will go over. Love doesn't bring you up to the edge of the cliff. Kindness and grace and gentleness, those don't bring you up to the edge. Anger puts you right on the edge. Your toes are hanging off. And just one slight misstep, and you have sinned. Anger is an extremely dangerous thing. Extremely dangerous. It's best not to exercise it at all. Then bring a curse. And remember, we're talking about righteous anger here. No question about it, Levi and Simeon had every right to be angry. I can't even imagine how angry I'd be if I was in their shoes. How angry would you be? If someone did to your wife, your daughter, your sister, what happened to their sister Dinah? Accursed is their rage, for it is intense, and their wrath, for it is harsh. And then look what Jacob says, I will separate them within Jacob, and I will disperse them in Israel. And sure enough, guess where Levi's inheritance was in Israel? If I put a map up here, could you show me where their inheritance is? It's not there. If I put up a map and say, show me Simeon's inheritance, where on the map is it? You can come a little closer. Simeon didn't get an inheritance as far as a piece of land. They were scattered throughout the tribe of Judah. A little bit here, there's a little bit of Simeon's people over here, and over there's a little piece of land where some Simeonites live. But their land is in the land of Simeon, or in the land of Judah. You can read about that in Joshua 19. I think it's around verse 4. So both of them, their inheritances were limited. I tell you what, you want to put the kibosh on your inheritance in the kingdom? Just give in to righteous anger. Be a person of anger, and your inheritance is greatly compromised. Well, what happened next with Simeon and Levi? They seem to begin to grow in different ways. And we mentioned, when you come to the story of the golden calf, Levi stands strong for the Lord, and Simeon gives in. When it comes to the waters of Massa and Meribah, according to Moses, it would seem Levi stands strong. Simeon gives in to the rest of the Israelites. And then you come to the book of Numbers. You come to the book of Numbers. And this interesting story, Numbers chapter 25. During the prayer service, Ben mentioned Balaam and how he was called upon to curse the Israelites, but each time he went to curse, blessings came out. So since he couldn't curse them outright, he took a back door. He counseled Balak how to really bring down the Israelites. He says, take your best-looking Midianite and Moabite women, I think it was the two of them together, send them into Israel, seduce the men, get them to worship other gods. Then you'll bring God's anger down upon them. You don't even have to curse them. God will take care of them for you. And sure enough, that's what happened. And when you come to Numbers chapter 25, it says in verse 1, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. For they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods. So Israel joined themselves to Baal Peor, and the Lord was angry against Israel. Now see, the Lord can be angry and do it right. This is why he says, vengeance is mine. I'll take vengeance. I'll take care of it. You're not qualified. You leave the vengeance to me. I run the vengeance department. It's not yours. Hands off. You'll just mess it up. But you know what we try to do? We try to do the vengeance part, and then God takes his hands off. All right, you want to do vengeance? Go ahead. And man, do we botch it up. We destroy the people we often are trying to protect, and then we just feed more the people that we're trying to take vengeance on and give them more ammo to use against us, and we make God's name stink. And finally, when we come back to the Lord, dragging our tail between our legs, just, sorry, God, forgive me for my anger. I want to stand back. I'm not going to take vengeance. And God says, okay, good, you step back. Now let me do it. Because when I take vengeance, it can do miraculous things. Because the anger of man does not work the righteousness of God, does it? But the anger of God does work the righteousness of God. Because God can be angry without ever missing the beat, because he runs the world. He knows how to apply it surgically. There have been times he's been angry with me, and probably times been angry with you. But it was the anger that was born out of love for us. It was an anger that came in to destroy the thing that's destroying us. And it was a pain he brought that was sent to preserve us and not to harm us. He does it spot on. We botch it every time. Anyways, I'm really digressing here. Well, then there was a man who came with one of these Moabite women right in front of the tabernacle. And they had to know full well what they were doing in the eyes of all Israel. Things had worked themselves up to such a point that this one Israelite man, this one Moabite woman, began to engage in terrible sin right there at the door of the tabernacle. And a young man named Pinchas, or Phinehas, as your Bibles may have it, was so incensed He took a spear, went up and ran the spear through both of them and into the ground and killed them. And when that happened, the plague that was coming, where tens of thousands died, the plague stopped immediately. And everybody's... And what always, it's almost funny. That's where the Torah portion ends, and then you have to wait till next week to find out what happens to Phinehas. And then when you come back the next week, it picks up. And God establishes his covenant of peace, of shalom, with Phinehas. And then we learn something that's really interesting. Phinehas, guess what tribe he's from? Levi. And what tribe is the other man from? Look at verse 14. Now the name of the slain man of Israel who was slain with the Midianite woman was Zimri, the son of Salu, a leader of a father's household among the Simeonites. Now we see a son of Levi killing a son of Simeon. Isn't that interesting? Doing it in anger, and then God establishing his covenant of peace with him. Now this seems completely backwards, doesn't it? Robin, your hand's up. That is always the question. Why is it Phinehas is taking vengeance? It's something blessed by God. I think God is telling us there is a time for righteous anger. But Phinehas, instead of trying to kill everybody in his path, went after these two. Somehow he was sensitive to God's spirit. He did that one act and stopped. And it turned out it was exactly right. It was very careful, very precise. Now, that doesn't mean we should still try to follow Phinehas' example. Because you don't find other examples like that. But that one is almost as if God is saying, I still can use a person to bring anger, to bring justice, but he's a tool in my hand. He doesn't freelance it on his own. No pun intended. Okay? And so we see Levi and Simeon starting to take a split. These two begin to take different directions. They're both men of strong passions, but Levi applies his passion towards God. Simeon applies his passion towards the flesh. It's almost like they're both born. You know, I remember Rabbi sharing this example. It says, now some people might be born with a bloodthirsty character. You think, oh, how awful. There might be two brothers. They're both born with this innate bloodthirsty character. One becomes a murderer. The other becomes a surgeon. The same character could be applied to completely different things. One to kill and one to heal. And it's like Levi and Simeon are born with the same identical nature. Jacob says, Simeon and Levi are brothers. But then later on, there's a change of path taken. You know, if you remember back in our study of Numbers, we did a comparison of the two censuses that were done in Numbers. One, oh, didn't plug that in. Excuse me a second. Okay. All right, here we go. One census is taken in the first chapter of Numbers, and another census taken later in chapter 26. Now, a lot of things have happened in between. There's some plagues and things, and God's brought some destruction and some blessings. But if you'll notice, in the right-hand column, some tribes have lost people, some have gained people, but the highest loss is in the tribe of Simeon. Over that period of time, they lost 37,100 people. They went from 59,300 in chapter 1 to 22,200 in chapter 26. 63% loss. The greatest loss of all the tribes of Israel. I think within us, as I said earlier, I think our sense of passion is at war with itself. We have a Simeon and a Levi within us. And we can give over to a passion in such a way that it's destructive. Our love for God, even that people whose love for God makes them totally intolerable, That's the kind of Simeon people. You know, they have this passion for God, but you just can't stand to be around them. Oh, why can't they just be normal, you know? Because they make God's name stink somehow. That's the kind of Simeon part of us. Or we can take our passion for God and keep it under self-control and apply it with knowledge. And then we bring incense before God. But when I hear somebody has a passion for God, I don't get that excited. I want to know how that passion's applied, don't you? You know what I mean? I don't know what this has to do with anything. I'll figure it out after I show it to you. But sometime back, Valerie gave me this cartoon. I think it's just pretty cool. It shows these little critters on an island, and there's a sheep out in the ocean here. And the critters are saying, "Who's that?" The other one says, "That's Wilhelm, the aquatic lamb." "Since when do lambs live in the ocean?" "Since Wilhelm convinced his entire flock to move there as a way to escape the wolves." "Where's his flock?" "The sharks ate them." Poor leadership skills. You know, one of the reasons I put this cartoon up is because Wilhelm, like so many believers, well-intentioned, have strong passions. Strong passions. And they allow their passions to control them instead of self-control and a cool head filled with Torah. And their hatred of the wolves leads them to something much worse, into the sharks. Just be careful of that. Let's not let a strong hatred of sin cause us to act in a way that's unloving to God and to people. Let's not let our righteous anger make God's name stink. And remember, when you give into strong passions, you will be scattered. Your inheritance is compromised. But now here's the thing I love. Here's the thing I just love about God. He prophesies that Simeon and Levi will be scattered through Israel because of their conspiracy, because of their violence. Yet Simeon's tribe is kind of lost, gets its little piddly bits here and there in Judah, and amounts to nothing. But Levi, because they learn the lesson God will teach them. He doesn't renege on saying they're going to be scattered. But what does he do? He makes them the priests, the teachers of Torah. He uses their scattering through Israel as a blessing to Israel. They don't inherit land, but they inherit the tithes of Israel. And of all the Israelites, they alone get to go into the temple. Of all the Israelites, they alone have the high priest who enters the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur to bring in the blood to atone for all of Israel. So even the thing that God does to them as punishment, God can take a turn completely upside down and make a tremendous blessing. Don't you ever dare think that your sin is somehow too big for God to handle. But remember Paul's words, where sin abounds, grace much more abounds. In God's hands, the size of your sin only becomes that much bigger of an opportunity. That's the way it is. In fact, I remember one place where he took the chief of sinners to write about a fourth of the Bible. Don't ever hold up your sin and say, this is just too big for God to handle. Shame on you. God's not threatened by your sin. It's not an excuse to do it. He's not threatened by your sin. Okay? I think we've gone long enough. I'm not done talking, but I can tell you're about done listening, so that's good enough. We'll just close it right there, okay? So let's close in prayer. Father, thank you so much for your Torah. Thank you for this lesson. And Lord, I know how many times with me, anger is kind of bubbling under the surface. Lord, may it just stay down there. For Lord, I can't remember any time in my life I got angry and anything good came of it. And Lord, it's so easy to hate sin. And we know even Satan himself accuses the brethren before your throne day and night. And he's not accusing them of doing things right. He's accusing them of the wrong things that they've done. And it's so easy to accuse others of everything they do wrong and to be angry about it and to become a tool of Satan himself. to join him in his accusations against your children. Father, may we instead be like Levi, who learned to take those passions and use them to bring a sacrifice to you, to teach your Torah, to be examples of holy living, to be clean in your sight, to bring incense before you. Father, I pray we would not mistake the one for the other, for they look so much alike. The Lord, help us to be people of self-control, who hate sin, yes, but we are controlled by love. Make us that kind of people, we ask in the precious name of Yeshua. Amen.